Hello and welcome to our Children's Rights in Action podcast series. Here at Children's Parliament, we believe that children should grow up in a world of love, happiness and understanding. Our mission is to inspire greater awareness and understanding of the power of children's human rights and to support the implementation of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, or the UNCRC, into Scots law. We're looking forward to sharing this with you through our conversations. Today, we want to focus on how we make children's rights real by sharing with you a conversation we had with Lynn Stevens and Susan Gardner of the Museum of Childhood.
Hello, my name is Lynn Stevens.
And I'm Susan Gardner.
And we're both curators at the Museum of Childhood in Edinburgh. As 2021 is Year of Childhood, we'd like to share with you our thoughts about the position of children in society and how this is reflected in the books that are written for children. The Museum of Childhood has a huge collection of many things which tell the story of British childhood through toys, games, clothes, photographs, and much, much more. But we also have about 20,000 books and comics and magazines, which gives us a really good idea about what children have read in the past. With such a large collection, it means we can be fairly confident that we have a good overall picture of the kind of things that children might be reading.
So we're going to try and think particularly about what effect books have had on children, what they thought and felt when they were reading the stories and what they thought about the characters in them. And that kind of information isn't always readily available, and it's also changed over time as children's books have changed. Books particularly for children started to be published from the 1850s onwards as technology developed, and there was a great increase in children's publishing in the early 20th century. At that point, people had more disposable income to spend on books, and also perhaps children might have had more pocket money to spend on books of their own choice.
So it's interesting for us to have a think about the different perspectives we can look at while we're having a conversation today. So we can think about what was the child who was reading the story, what were they thinking about the story, and what were they thinking about the characters in the book and what happened to them and how that relates to themselves. We can also think about the person that was writing the story for the children to read. So, you know, what was the motivation there from the author? Were they looking to entertain a child or instruct a child? And what did they think a child might want to read?
Yeah, there's lots of different elements in this, aren't there? Because there's also the people who were buying the books. So mostly in the past, it would have been adults buying the books for a child, probably for a birthday present or a Christmas present, or perhaps they were getting a school prize or a Sunday school prize. So the adult in that case might have been buying a particular kind of book, you know, to encourage specific behaviour. And this also might have had an affected who was publishing the book and what publisher they chose. So I'm thinking particularly here about the Religious Tract Society, who published huge numbers of books for children, for boys and girls, including magazines, particularly the Boys' Own and the Girls' Own magazines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we need to think about as well, you know, what children might have wanted to read, but maybe the adults didn't want them to read. Mm-hmm. So, you know, most of the time it was the parents or, well, adults that were buying the books for children. Maybe it was aunts and uncles or friends or grandparents or whatever for Christmas and birthdays. But they would definitely have had there'd have been a filter there about what they thought was suitable for a child to read, or even what they thought a child might enjoy. It might be different from what the child themselves actually thinks or did think at the time. I know very much sort of mid to late 19th century, for example, it was seen that novels were quite sort of dangerous things for girls to read because it gave them, you know, ideas about doing things that were maybe unladylike or not good behaviour. But they were still being published in huge numbers. So people were definitely reading them. And I think from, you know, what we can tell from inscriptions we find in the book collection, Susan, you know, there were child readers as well, probably teenagers rather than small children, but they were definitely reading novels, even if they were thought by some people as unsuitable.
So what was considered suitable for children to read in the late 19th century?
Well, I think before, you know, to think about that, you've got to think about when children were learning to read. And, you know, the literacy rates hugely went up after the Education Act in Scotland in 1872, which meant there was compulsory attendance at schools. And through the schools, children would have come to books. So either they would have had them read to them or they would have read themselves in school. There would have been Sunday schools. Obviously in the Sunday schools, there would have been a religious theme to the books. I think there'd be a certain amount of choice for children, but I think that, you know, a lot of it would have been filtered through what the adults were buying for them. And a lot of the 19th century books were huge, you know, bestsellers that we still know of today, like Alice in Wonderland, which was published in 1865, and then Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island, it was published in 1883. So both of those portrayed a child as like the main character in a book. So there'd been an element of children recognising themselves in those stories, even if they were, you know, like Alice in Wonderland obviously isn't the real world, and there's an element of fantasy there, and not many people would end up on a treasure island. But, you know, there were still sort of children as sort of the main character in the book. I also wanted to mention there was a book by Catherine Sinclair, an Edinburgh author, called Holiday House, and that was published quite early in 1839. Although there would have been a lot of instructional books, even in, you know, in fiction where there was sort of an element of what children should be doing, Holiday House was a really interesting one in that it was very much about the children getting, you know, being slightly mischievous and getting up to things that maybe they shouldn't have been, but without a big moral ending. And in the preface of her book, I'm just going to read this, Catherine says, "While every effort is made to stuff the memory like a cricket ball with well-known facts and ready-made opinions, no room is left for the vigour of natural feeling." And I think from that we get a sense that she was trying to let the child reader's natural feeling come through in her story.
Yeah, so Holiday House is often mentioned as quite a different type of story, isn't it? Where there wasn't that moral didactic feeling. Although I think a lot of people say that Alice in Wonderland was also, you know, a different kind of story where it was purely entertainment. So they're both seen as quite, you know, on the cusp of doing something slightly different for children. But it's interesting that Alice obviously has endured and is still really famous, and Holiday House is quite an obscure title, but there's a lot of books in that position, aren't there, that we don't know about anymore?
Yes, I mean, we see it in the collection. There's lots of titles that we're not familiar with, but we see there's been lots of copies of them, or lots of editions, you know, say 10th or 11th edition. So one that I found was called Jessica's First Prayer, which I don't think anyone's heard of now unless they're particularly interested in children's books. It was published by the Religious Tract Society. It was written by a woman called Sarah Smith and published in 1866. And it talks about a very poor child in London. She's been abandoned by her. It alludes to her alcoholic mother, and there's no mention of her father. And you know, she's very destitute, and she's she takes up with the coffee seller, you know, and who starts to give her sort of few food and look after her. And then there's this sort of this reversal whereby he then learns from her, you know. So there's a very sort of there's a very strong underlying Christian theme to it, and it's about, you know, forgiveness and understanding and finding the right path in life. And at the time of its publication, it outsold Alice in Wonderland. Amazing. So, you know, it was huge. Everyone in 1860s and 70s would have heard of Jessica's First Prayer and probably had a copy in their own homes. But yeah, so, you know, that sort of style of book, very didactic and moralistic, is out of fashion. So I think there's still elements of that, but it's more subtle. So yes, yeah, so we don't hear about that particular book or other titles now.
Mm-hmm. And because that the character in that book was a girl, chances are then that book was mostly read by girls, because books for boys and girls were quite separate really at that time, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we can, I mean, there'd be some books that boys and girls might have both read, like perhaps Wind in the Willows. But, you know, then animals are the central characters. But girls were definitely pictured in books as being, you know, in domestic settings, whereas boys was, you know, out and about in the world and having adventures. So, yeah, it's like boys were in the public realm, as it were, as the men were in the 19th century. They ran the public world in office and empire and the church and law and everything. And the boys' books were set around adventures, and often in places that were part of the British Empire, involving military figures, or explorers, you know, people that were sort of, you know, either types of male figures that were popular, say, in newspaper articles and stuff, and sort of, you know, transposed into these sort of children's fictions. So a couple of titles that jumped out at me when I was having a look was, there's one called In the Heart of the Rockies, A Story of Adventure in Colorado, and another one is A Final Reckoning, a tale of bush life in Australia. And they were both by G.A. Henty, who wrote lots of these sort of, you know, adventure books, and other male authors like Herbert Strang and Percy F. Westerman, you know, they, much as sort of later authors in the 20th century wrote lots of books, you know, they wrote lots as well. So, you know, children could enjoy a particular author and buy lots of those. But I think those kind of sort of like books fell out of favour a wee bit once we got to the 1930s. So they were really popular at the end of the 19th century and the Edwardian period at the beginning of the 20th century.
So although those books were aimed at boys, I think probably lots of girls read them as well, especially if they had brothers or cousins, you know, if they had access to the books. They might not have been given them, but they probably did have a read of them sometimes. But obviously there were other books that were aimed at girls, so what sort of things were they supposed to be reading?
Well, I mean, as you say, that, you know, if the books were in the house or the library or in the schoolroom, there wasn't necessarily anything stopping a child picking a book that wasn't necessarily deemed for them originally. But I think, as I alluded to, often with the books aimed at girls, the main characters are in their domestic setting or just very local within a sort of a village or, you know, or a school that we'll talk about later. So like Little Women, which was published in 1868, and Anne of Green Gables, which was published in 1908, very much focused on the home. You know, the March sisters are very much helping their mother with chores, talking to neighbours, and, you know, I think one of them goes and works for somebody nearby. So it's very much, you know, they haven't ventured far. Their adventures are on a small scale. Same with sort of Anne of Green Gables. You know, Anne was always being told that she was too boisterous and, you know, she used to calm down. So it's kind of like, so they're sort of, probably the girls reading them would see themselves reflected in their lifestyle. So they would be seeing domestic environment that they are familiar with, as opposed to going somewhere they've never heard of. They would certainly have read Treasure Island and White Fang and Uncle Tom's Cabin. And, you know, and I mean, I've mentioned some of these American publications because obviously children in Britain were reading those as well. Outside of the home, perhaps the school was the most popular setting for a plot. The trick of the narrative is that if you know, if you're away at a boarding school, then there's no parents around, you know, it gives another sort of element of adventure and children, girls or boys, being together in a place and, you know, sort of working together. So Susan, I know you really enjoy the books set in schools. Could you tell us a little bit more about maybe what those books were like and when those were being published?
Yeah, there's so many school stories for children, and they did tend to be separate, either stories for girls or stories for boys, and as you say, based in boarding schools mostly. The first one that started it all off was Tom Brown's School Days by Thomas Hughes. That was published in 1857, and it was really looking at the early public schools for boys and focusing a lot on the ethos of those schools and, you know, the emphasis on team games and sport, which was really coming into being at that time, and so competitiveness, but also leadership and loyalty to the school or to your group of friends or to your country or whatever. So all these values were being promoted through the school stories, and there were lots of spin-offs after Tom Brown's School Days that were, you know, much in the same mode. And girls' school stories were actually very similar to the boys' school stories. They had much the same ideas. And I thought it was really interesting that in almost 100 years after Tom Brown's School Days, Enid Blyton was setting school stories as well. And so she had two series of school stories, but in one of them, second form at St. Clair's, this is written in 1944, she has one of her pupils saying to another girl, "We have to learn to work together as a team, each one for his side, helping the others, not each one for himself." That sort of thing is especially good for you, Alison. You'd sit in the corner and look at yourself in the mirror all day long if you could. So,
poor Alison.
You know, it does come over a little bit pompous now when you're reading that, but you know, it's that same spirit, you know, had been going through all these school stories for all that time and really hadn't changed an awful lot. So and I think in some ways the school story for girls was still quite a domestic story, because, you know, school would have been a familiar setting in the 1940s, but when you were looking a bit earlier, say turn of the century or the beginning of the 20th century, this was quite an exotic setting for girls, because not many of them were being educated in that way or having the opportunity to go away from home. And the idea of running around a hockey pitch, you know, was incredible, because they didn't normally have that kind of physical freedom to run about and be energetic like boys did. So this would be in the realms of fantasy for a lot of girls at that point in time. Yeah. And even, you know, the boys' stories, it was in a similar vein to the adventure stories, because, again, there was this ethos of, you know, being, you know, the manly leader and building up to the sort of person that you would be once you left school and went out into the world. And later on, I think when you get to about the 1960s and 70s, when women were still remembering reading these girls' school stories, I think by this time there were fewer opportunities for girls and boys to do things separately. You know, most schools would be co-educational by this time. So the idea of the girls' boarding school had gone into the realms of fantasy in a different way, because it was such a novelty to be in a world where it was all women and girls and women were making the decisions and they were in charge of things and, you know, were deciding their own destiny and not being told what to do by groups of men, which was, you know, a bit of a novelty at that point. So I think the school story has appealed to girls in different ways, depending on what life was like for them at the time that they were reading them. And there were definitely some very particular authors who wrote lots of school stories. Enid Blyton, I've mentioned, wrote thousands of stories anyway, but she had her two series of school stories, Mallory Towers and St. Clair's. But before her, there was the Shalley School series by Eleanor M. Brent Dyer, which must have stretched to about 50 books. And then earlier still, there was Elsie Oxenham and Dorita Fairley Bruce in Scotland. And I think Angela Brazil is the name that lots of people will remember. It was all, you know, that very much Jim Slip and Jolly Hockey Sticks and all that.
And I think it's interesting because, you know, we've touched a lot on maybe the girls' perspective of reading these characters and how it fitted with their, you know, real life scenarios and society. But, you know, I think it must have been interesting to think, you know, for the boys as well, because, you know, they probably felt certain, you know, women, the girls might have felt a pressure to behave a certain way in the domestic setting, but, you know, the boys were given these sort of scenarios that they were supposed to live up to as well. And I wonder whether they, you know, read some of the other books that were aimed at girls as well, or whether, you know, they were very much feeling, you know, they were being, especially the early 20th century, being funneled into sort of empire and serving in the, you know, in the military or the public sector. But I was wondering as well, so, you know, we sort of talked about some of the earlier books, but what were children then sort of reading once we'd got into sort of the later first half of the 20th century? And you touched on Enid Blyton. She obviously wrote a lot of books.
Yeah. Yes, well, I think everyone will remember the famous Five series and the Secret Seven. And before her, probably one of the popular series was the Swallows and Amazons books. And these were a little bit gentler in tone, so they were probably family groups of siblings or cousins, both boys and girls, who were off having sort of smaller scale adventures in the school holidays, you know, things that we wouldn't let children do nowadays, you know, go off in a sailing boat by yourself and
come back in a week. Don't we won't worry where you are.
No, unheard of, really. But you know, but they were, it was you know, quite testing for them, having to make decisions about what to do, and you know, there's always a baddie lurking around the corner, and so these were quite exciting stories for children. And they do depict a very different lifestyle that, you know, that seems a bit strange to us now. And I have to mention your favourite quote from Five Have a Wonderful Time, where Anne suddenly says, "I must wash up."
Because we all love to wash up.
Yes, she's the domestic one, isn't she? But
yes.
I think that's probably... part of Enid Blyton's success is that in these stories she tends to have a group of children, and so there's room to have different types of character within the group. So
yes,
you know, you've always got, like in the famous Five, Julian is the eldest, so he's always the leader and in charge, telling people what to do, and Dick's his second in command, and then George, who's actually called Georgina, who's the tomboy girl, she's the one who's always out there wanting to do everything first and do the dangerous stuff, and
yeah,
and then Anne is sort of lagging behind, doing the tidying yeah up and making sure they've got something to eat and things. So I suppose if you're reading this story, you know, you can identify with one of the characters, or maybe different ones at different points in the story, thinking about, you know,
yeah,
what you would
yeah
do in the situation.
It's a bit like the four main characters in some of the Narnia books. You know, you've got the sensible ones and the ones being a bit silly, and the when the ones, you know, the smallest one never being listened to because they're the youngest, you know, it's all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But what about, so we've talked quite a lot about fiction, but what about non-fiction books? I mean, were there lots of those available for children to read? Was it something, do you think, they would have enjoyed reading?
I think there were a huge number of non-fiction books. I mean, we do have hundreds of them in the museum's collection, and books on all sorts of different subjects, you know, inventions, natural history, great figures in history. Also, one of the biggest publications in the early 20th century was Arthur Mee's Encyclopedia, Children's Encyclopedia, which first came out in 1908. And this was sort of groundbreaking publication at the time, because it was intended to be educational, but they also wanted it to be entertaining for children. So it was written in a different way from a lot of other non-fiction books. Not exactly lighthearted, but trying to appeal to children and get them interested, because it wasn't a school book. They were reading this at home in their own time. But it was a very middle class publication. I think probably only a certain kind of child would have been given this book. And you can see when you flip through the contents that they stick very much to safe subjects a lot of the time. You know, they don't ever really talk about poverty or, you know, children who are living in different kinds of homes. They do mention women and men, but they wouldn't talk about controversial subjects like women's suffrage or, you know, anything that,
like conscientious objectors or anything
yes
like that.
Yes, I think it's quite yeah safe subjects, and I think there's a yeah definite tone coming through the publication that, you know, it's a Christian publication and it's probably quite royalist, loyal to queen and country and the empire, and probably looking particularly at a British white audience, talking about other countries of the Commonwealth in a respectful tone, but definitely thinking, you know, we're the ones who have the upper hand and we're in charge and all's right with the world as it is.
And I guess as well as that, you know, this is obviously before we all had the internet at our fingertips, and, you know, the non-fiction books could be I imagine fascinating worlds you could dive into. I remember looking at an encyclopedia when I was a child, and I think what's interesting as well, you can see, you know, the various, there's like series of books, aren't there, the ones you've mentioned, there's the Wonder Books, and they're, you know, about engineering or ships or nature, and, you know, there's lots of books about nature and, you know, natural sciences, but also just, you know, sort of flowers and you know, more sort of what's the word, you know, creative sort of ways of looking at nature and poetry and things like that. But but yeah, I think it's interesting because I think for us as well, looking at them now, we can see what the sort of technological developments were at the time. So, you know, the children would have looked at these presumably and found things about new inventions exciting, and, you know, the cameras or, you know, cinema and things like that, which maybe, you know, we look at it now and just think, oh yeah, that's interesting, but, you know, for them that would have been like, wow. So
the ones about historical figures are interesting as well, aren't they, about who was seen to be an eminent person at the time. And our favorite book in the collection, which is called Sisters of Famous Men.
That's right, it's the best title, because obviously women couldn't be important in their own right. They had to be a sister of a famous man.
I'm very pleased that we've got books nowadays to balance that out, because I think recently there have been quite a few publications about famous women, and we're just going to mention two of them that are quite popular, and one is called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls. I think a lot of people will have come across that. And there's also a book called Fantastically Great Women Who Changed the World, written by Kate Pankhurst, who is actually a descendant of Emmeline Pankhurst, the suffragist. So we've balanced it up a bit now,
So I think before we wrap this up, I just want to ask you one more thing about, do you think stereotyping is still a feature in modern children's books? Or, I mean, you've just touched on that we've obviously, you know, the gender balance might be balancing up a bit more, but
yes, I think that is. And I think there was also a sort of shift in the kind of stories children were reading in the mid-20th century, when people started to be more aware of class structure in Britain. And certainly after the Second World War, I think there was more of a move towards writing stories for a broader background of children. There's an author called Geoffrey Treese who wrote for children, and he said that in the late 1940s, he had lots of conversations with teachers about what books children were reading, and they asked him, why are there no modern stories in working class settings? You know, nannies and ponies mean nothing to the sorts of children that we're teaching. And I think it did broaden out at this point, and this is partly because there was a wider group of people writing for children as well, and they started to come from different backgrounds and weren't the sort of solidly middle class authors that we'd had before. And so there was a new feeling that children's stories should reflect real life a little bit more and not be quite so, you know, in the realms of fantasy. So I think this is coming at the same time as a shift in culture generally, when we had, you know, the move towards different theatre plays and then what they called kitchen sink drama, and the start of things like Coronation Street was almost on the verge of happening, where we're looking at ordinary people. So the same thing was happening with children's books, one in particular that people might have heard of is Jim Starling by E.W. Hildick. That was published in 1958, and it was set in the industrial north of England, where the author had grown up and obviously was familiar with that setting. And you know, authors started to write about illness and the war came up as a subject. So children were being expected to take on quite a sort of hefty subject matter. But it's interesting how the authors can often deal with this in a in an appropriate way for children. I'm thinking particularly about Jacqueline Wilson, who's an incredibly popular author, has been for the last, I don't know, 10, 20 years. And she writes about, you know, divorce, families splitting up, domestic violence, all sorts of things that you would think, oh, I don't really want my children to read about this. But, you know, she writes it from the child's point of view. So I think she's introducing subjects that are difficult, but possibly what lots of children are experiencing. And that came from her own childhood experience. And she wrote that I knew from right from a very early age that I wanted to write very different sort of books. I wanted to write books that didn't seem to exist yet, books about realistic children who had difficult parents and all sorts of secrets and problems. The only book written for children that struck me in any way realistic was The Family from One End Street by Eve Garnett, a story about a poor family where dad's a dustman, mum's a washerwoman, and there are seven children. So, you know, quite different really from Narnia or even from the famous Five.
I suppose what we can, I think, as a sort of overall reflection on, obviously we could talk about this for hours, but I think, you know, when we look at the collection and we see the huge variety that's there and the range, and, you know, we've got a good 150 years worth of children's literature. And, you know, we sometimes see the child reader when they've scribbled on their book or they've coloured in a picture or made a little comment, which is always a lovely insight. But I think the sort of main reflection is that, of, you know, we can see that books are written within their time and they reflect a certain age, as you say, you know, the sort of what society is thinking or dealing with at a particular time. And I think, you know, the child has become more maybe at the forefront of, you know, adventures and, you know, broader sort of feelings are involved, broader issues are involved. And I mean, we still have fundamentally, I think, similar kind of books. So we'll still have books, you know, fantasy worlds, books set in the real world, some with a sort of maybe a lesson to be learnt, but maybe a more subtle one. And I think maybe, just sort of more variety of people and situations represented than there might have been, say, when we were looking at the earlier 19th century ones. So I have to ask you, Susan, what was your favourite book as a child?
That's too difficult one. I can possibly pick one book. There's too many of them. I mean, the Shelley School series by Eleanor M. Brentdyer, I have to mention that because that was one of my favourites. And those books weren't in print when I was that age. They were, I had to get them in the library. So that was, you know, even more of a lure that you had to wait, you know, because we only went to the library once a week, so you got your four books and that had to keep you going till the next time. So I definitely enjoyed reading those. I think Little Women is one of my favourite books and I still enjoy reading that now. I think that would be my desert island book if I had to choose one to take. And I think it's just amazing that it was written, you know, such a long time ago, but it's still, it's very readable now. And, you know, those relationships between the sisters are still very real and you could almost translate it into the present day, I think. And they have, you know, the whole story is about doing good, isn't it? And being a good person in a lot of ways, but the way that it's written, it's not off-putting. It's not preachy. I think that's a lovely story. And I have to mention one more. So a book that I read at primary school was called An Edinburgh Reel by Iona McGregor, and that's set in the old town of Edinburgh, I think in the early 19th century, maybe a little bit earlier, and that's the book that really got me interested in Edinburgh's history, and I would definitely recommend that if you can find a secondhand copy somewhere.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard of that one. That's interesting.
I'll have to lend you it.
I think I very distinctly remember reading, when I was primary school age, I remember reading Famous Five, Secret Seven, Roald Dahl. I remember Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And I had a sister that was almost 10 years older, so I kind of inherited like her library. And I've And so a lot of those, the Enid Blytons were in that. I remember reading a few classics like Alice in Wonderland and Black Beauty. And I almost got into a horse phase, but then didn't. Some of my friends were really into horses, but I didn't quite get to that. And then I think when I hit teenage year, you know, I used to go to the library, like you say, every week, get my stash of books. And I think when I got to that age, there were sort of like Judy Blume books, you know, where teenagers were, you know, exploring their feelings and maybe what they thought about boys or girls. And, you know, and so, yeah, they're sort of the ones that I, you know, stay in my head. I definitely remember reading and occasionally go back and read ones that I've read when I was a child as well. And sort of sometimes that's good because you still enjoy it. And sometimes if you don't enjoy it as much, then you think, oh, that's a shame. But yeah. Anyway, I guess we better bring this to a close or we'll be talking all day, much as I'd love to. So anyway, I hope everyone listening to this has enjoyed our thoughts about what children have been reading over the last 100 or so years and maybe how they saw themselves in those books or what they thought about them. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed it. And do go and read some children's books. You're never too old to read a child book.
Thank you ever so much for listening to today's episode. If you'd like to learn more about our work, please visit www.childrensparliament.org.uk.